But anyway, one day we were in the wagon line, quite a few hours, and somebody came along and said, oh, the war's finished. Oh? Well, just go down about half a mile down the road and look in the field there, you'll see. Won't tell us why. Anyway, we went down and quite a crowd there. And there were tanks, things we'd never seen or heard of.
Tanks. Tanks. It's that time again. It's the middle of September and the 107th anniversary of the coming of the tanks, that first tank, use of tanks at Fleur on the 15th of September 1916 has come round again. And I recorded 12 months ago one of the most popular podcasts with Pete Smith, who lives in Fleur and a battlefield guide, and he explained to us what happened in and around his village on that day, the 15th of September 1916. But ever since then, it's stuck in my mind that we've only scratched the surface, as we do with all of these battles when we talk about them. And I wanted to know more about those tanks and more about the men that fought in those tanks on that day. Who were these men? Where did they come from? What did they think? And what about the tanks? How were they manufactured? How were they tested? And it's another one of those coincidences, because recently I went to Lincoln. And that's really the birthplace of the tanks. That's where many of them were built, in what was an agricultural, a farming factory. In the area where that factory was, it's empty now. There's no sign of the factories that were there. It's an area of university and it's been completely regenerated in recent years. But on a roundabout, there is a fantastic memorial to one of those original tanks. And we're going to talk about that on this podcast. And we're also going to talk briefly about where those tanks were tested before they went out to the Somme in the early summer, the spring of 1916. But of course, as this is Tales from the Battlefields podcast, we're going to talk about the men. We're going to look at their accounts, what it was like to actually fight on that day in September of 1916. It really did change history that day. And the army still learn so much today when they're using their tanks from what happened in those early days. As usual, with everything in warfare, everything in life, things evolve, and they certainly did when we come to talk about the tanks. So the Battle of Fleur-Courcelette began on the 15th of September, as we know, and it really did change the nature of modern warfare, this tank. The idea of the battle, the aim of the battle, was to wear down the German resistance, to pave the way for a breakthrough through the third German line. And these tanks would combine the mobility of infantry with the firepower of the artillery. It's putting the two together, really, isn't it? They'd be able to traverse the trenches, crush the barbed wire, and it would allow the infantry to follow. Now, that first battle in September 1916 was, of course, a very primitive affair. It had not been done before. People were learning on their feet, I suppose. And within the tanks, the visibility was poor. There were seven men in there, cramped into that small space. It was extremely hot. The armour was thin. The noise was so great they couldn't hear each other. They had to communicate by hand signals. And the engine was intensely unreliable. There were 49 tanks which arrived in France ready for this battle. Only 32 of them arrived at the starting point. And of those, 14 broke down straight away. Eight were knocked out by shell fire. And two caught fire without any help from the enemy whatsoever. But they achieved success that day. They took several of those villages within the German line, Courcelette, Fleur, High Wood was taken by the 47th Division. And that had held out, of course, for weeks. I'm going to have a podcast about that soon as well. But I've read several books for this podcast, and it seems that the battle, in hindsight, is looked upon as a reasonable success. It definitely inspired terror amongst the German enemy. Some of them had fled, some of them had been killed, lots of prisoners taken. It definitely bolstered the British morale. That had taken a battering, of course, over what had happened in the first couple of months of the Somme advance. And they'd taken a mile of enemy territory across a six-mile front. So that was progress, wasn't it? And as we keep saying, there was lots of learning points that the Allies used. They took forward to the Battle of Cambrai in 1917. And then, as we discussed in a recent podcast about Amiens, the lessons from this battle was certainly used during the great advance of 1918. So what I'm going to do now is play an interview that I recorded with a man called Richard Pullin. And he lives in Lincoln, the birthplace of the tanks. And he's, as you'll find out, turned himself into sort of an expert over the last 40 years or so. since he found out something about his grandfather that led him to a passion in tanks. So without any further ado, let's hear what Richard has got to say. What's your background then, Richard? How did you get into it?
You know, growing up in Lincoln, I knew about the story of the tanks being created in Lincoln, but it wasn't until 1982 when my granddad died.
Yeah.
And we found a photograph of some young lads sat in front of a tank at a factory.
Yep.
And a little war work badge for William Foster and Company Limited. And started doing a bit of digging. And it turns out that he had worked there. He'd been on the team that had created the first tanks in 1916.
And that was your granddad, did you say? That was your granddad?
Yeah, my grandfather, yeah.
Oh, you've got a direct link with it then, haven't you? Wow.
The problem is, though, he never said a word about it. So I've spent the next 40 years trying to research what he could have told me in 20 minutes if he'd sat down and talked about it. But he never did. I think they were told it was top secret, and he took that to his grave. He never said a word about it all his life.
That generation,
he kept the photograph and the badge.
It's that generation.
They did their bit, and that was done with.
Yes.
And everybody had a story. So why harp on about it? Get on with the rest of your life.
I think that's what happened. You know, all these stories of soldiers, and then they went back to being grocers, working in factories, gardeners, that sort of thing. They just got on with it, didn't they? Especially with the state of the economy in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah.
I don't think they had much choice. So, that's how you got into it. So tell me about William Foster then. Who was William Foster and what was he doing before the war with his factory?
Well, William Foster, he started the business in Lincoln in the 1850s. And it was a flour mill for a start. And for some reason, he decided it'd be a good idea to stop being a flour mill, which he was very successful at, and become an iron founders, even though there were lots of other iron founders in the area. But he did do very well, and the business went from strength to strength. And unfortunately, he died a few years later, typhoid, I think it was. But the company was so successful, it carried on without him under his name. So William Foster and Company carried on right up until the 1960s.
Yeah.
So it was very successful for years after he had gone. But we've really got to thank their managing director, William Tritton.
Tritton, yeah.
For the First World War. He came to Foster's from Garrett's, another steam engine manufacturer, in 1905. And he came up, had all sorts of ideas, and he was a really driven sort of a chap and went all over the world looking for new markets for them and had all sorts of new ideas about steam engines and things. And he was just the man when it came to creating a tank in the First World War, just the man we needed.
Mm. It was quite inspirational looking at the accounts I've read about him. And under his wing, there's two other names that keep cropping up, William Rigby and Walter Wilson.
That's right, yeah. So Walter Wilson was the other half, really, the other side of the coin. So Tritton and Wilson, they were the men who created this amazing thing.
Yeah.
And I always think Wilson was sent up by the military to keep an eye on these civilians, because it wasn't like Foster's wasn't a military establishment at all. They were making these 105 horsepower tractors for the Admiralty, but they weren't a military establishment. They were just an agricultural company. So they sent Walter Wilson up to keep an eye on things. Walter Wilson was a design genius. He understood gearboxes and better than anyone else, I think. So he and Tritton sort of gelled really well and became this brilliant design team. They were sketching designs on the back of cigarette packets and envelopes and coming up with ideas all over the place. So it was Rigby. He was the chief draftsman at Foster's, and it was his job to take these half-finished ideas and just make them into drawings that somebody could work from.
Everyone needs someone like that, don't they?
Another really good designer, really understood engines and gearboxes and everything. And he's not mentioned, but he really was the third man in that design team. Yeah,
but they haven't got long though, have they? Because they're doing their tractors and things, and it's only a few months before tanks are first used at Fleur when they start actually putting the first tank into production. How did that happen then?
Yeah, this is it. I mean, they knew that time really was of the essence. Every day that went past, men were dying, and they knew they had an idea for something which could cut the war short, hopefully.
Yeah.
All it was, this simple idea, was something that was heavy enough to crush barbed wire and armoured enough to be impervious to the machine gun fire. That's all they wanted.
Yeah.
And so Foster's, they took all the mechanical parts from one of their 105 horsepower tractors, the engine and so on, this wonderful Daimler sleeve valve 105 horsepower engine.
Yeah.
And they put it in this box, this armored hull.
Yeah.
And lots of experiments with tracks and all sorts of things. And it really is amazing how quickly they created a prototype. And then from prototype to actual production vehicles was just a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
Before they started to appear, you know, in just in dribs and drabs.
Yeah.
At the training grounds, and the soldiers actually started to get their hands on the first few. And then after that, production stepped up. And Foster's was a very small factory, really, so production had to go elsewhere. So in the end, they were made in other factories all over the place.
Yes.
Birmingham being the biggest one, I think. Yeah, Metropolitan yeah. Wagon and Finance Company in Birmingham. Albury there, they made more than anybody.
But the first one...
So, yeah, it all comes back to Lincoln, yeah.
But the first one, which they called Little Willie, after William Tritton, is that right?
This is it. Yeah, this is it. The very first one, it was originally the Lincoln number one machine, but yeah. They quite rightly decided that was a bit too descriptive.
Yeah.
If it was going to be top secret, they didn't want everyone knowing where it was designed and where it was invented. So they decided to call it Little Willie instead. So yeah. The original Lincoln number one machine had American off-the-shelf tracks and a turret on the top. So people often say that the Renault FT was the first First World War tank with a turret. It wasn't really. It was the first production First World War tank with a turret, but the Lincoln number one had a turret.
Yeah.
But as a tank, it was never going to work. It was never going to go into production.
No.
The tracks weren't great. So Tritton and Wilson tried to come up with another idea for the tracks, and they came up with what they called the Tritton tracks. It was so simple. The American tracks had a tendency to sag and fall off when they went over trenches, over a gap, which is what they weren't made for that, really.
No.
So the Tritton track, it would stay on. So it had a little slot in the track shoes and a little rail on the hull. So the two stayed together. They couldn't really fall off.
And
once they designed that, you know, they could build anything they wanted.
Yeah.
But they went from the Lincoln number one, then the one with the Tritton tracks, that was Little Willie. And Little Willie was the first proper prototype. It was great off-road, did really well at its tests. But it couldn't cross large trench, and it couldn't claw its way back up the other side of a trench. There are two theories, really, as to why it was called Little Willie. The prevailing theory seems to be that it was a bit of a dig at the Kaiser's son, Little Willie.
Yeah.
And that's what people seem to think. But then there's another theory that, you know, why would you name your top secret new device after the enemy?
Yeah.
And it could just be that it was called Little Willie. William Tritton was Big Willie. He was a big chap. And this was Little Willie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could just be that, because up until now, he had named a lot of his creations after himself. You had the Tritton track.
Yeah.
The Tritton trench crosser was an early experiment where they took one of the tractors and lengthened the front end, and they had this complicated bridging system to try and get over trenches. But that was named after Tritton as well. So Little Willie could just be another vehicle named after its creator.
Yeah, 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 it makes sense, doesn't it? And it was just, I understand it was just 37 days to produce that first tank.
This is it, yeah, absolutely, that's right. Looking back, you can't imagine that they got the drawings prepared in that amount of time.
No.
But that's exactly what they did.
And then when they were in full production, this small factory, though, in Lincoln, there was hundreds, thousands of people there, wasn't there, at one point?
This is it. It was a huge effort to create these tanks. Just in Lincoln and Lincolnshire alone, you had everyone on a tank footing. Blacksmiths were making track pins, and all other companies like Rustin's and Clayton Shuttleworths and so on in Lincoln were making parts for tanks, sponsons and pumps and track links and all kinds of things. So it was a real community effort, really. And then when you end up with the tanks being made all over the place, as I say, in Birmingham mainly, there were thousands of people working on this project.
And a lot of them women, of course, weren't they?
Churning out these tanks by the trainload.
And a lot of them were women, I understand.
That's right, yeah, this is it. As with the rest of the country, really, because Kitchener had said in 1914, I want a million men.
Yeah.
And you can't just take a million men out of the workforce
yeah,
and expect the country to carry on as it was.
Yeah.
So luckily we had this workforce who were ready and eager.
Yeah.
You know, they were after the vote. They wanted to prove they were equal. So they were ready and eager to go into the factories, the docks, the farms, anywhere we asked them to. And they proved they were more than equal, the women in the First and Second World War.
Yeah, definitely.
And a lot of the tank production was created by the women. And it would have been a very unfamiliar surroundings for women at that time. These basically Victorian foundries were very noisy, dark, dusty, horrible places full of dangerous machinery. You know, very unpleasant places to be. So, yeah, I've got absolute admiration for the women who stepped up and did what they did in both World Wars, yeah.
And I think that takes us on to, when you go to Lincoln, what is there to see now? And this is how I came across the story of Lincoln, was when I went to see a relative there recently, and he took me down to this roundabout in the middle of the university area, and there's this splendid memorial showing women and men and designers and biographies of the three men that we talked about, bang in the middle of this roundabout. Why is it there? Why is that memorial there and that roundabout in the university area?
Yeah, the Lincoln Tank Memorial, it's got a bit of a story, really, because in 1918, the end of the war, there were lots of tanks put all over the country as memorials, these presentation tanks. Hundreds of them were given out. They were every town or, you know, big village you can imagine.
Yeah, we had a tank one. We had one in the park.
Yeah, this is it. At one time, they were all over the place.
Yep.
But one by one, they've been scrapped. And Lincoln had one, and it was scrapped, unfortunately. But there was a call at that time. There should be some sort of special memorial to the fact the tank was created in Lincoln. That came to nothing, and then there was another plan to have a tank placed in Burton Park in Lincoln, where Mother and Little Willie had their first test, you know, the very first prototype rhomboid tank had their first test. Then a bit later on in the 1950s, there was a plan to put a brick tank next to the road near the old Foster's factory in Lincoln, but that came to nothing. So eventually we decided, right, this has gone on long enough, we need to actually do something. So we started fundraising and getting a group together, and luckily we had solicitors and the mayor's aide and artists and historians and all sorts of people on the committee for the memorial. And so it was great putting it together. It was a bit of a bittersweet moment when it was finished, really, because it was great to see it there, but it was a shame to think, well, we're not going to do any more. But
the end of a process.
Yeah, so in 2016, so that was 100 years after the creation of the tank, the memorial was unveiled, and it's 1.5 times actual size, even though the tank's an enormous thing, but even at 1-to-1 scale, it would have been lost in that huge roundabout. So we did it 1-to-1.
Yeah.
And it's made of Core 10 steel, the same as the Angel of the North. It'll rust, but it won't rust away. It just gets that coating on it. But it really, it's a memorial to those civilian workers.
Yeah.
And as you said, there's lots of women there and the men handing spanners to each other and carrying the track links about. And at the front, we've got Tritton, Wilson and Rigby looking at a huge stainless steel drawing of a Mark I tank. It's fabulous thing. It's come out better than we could ever have imagined, I think.
It's one of the best memorials I've seen, because I was there about 15-20 minutes, and every time I looked at it and I walked round it, is it two-dimensional, is that what you call it? And as you walk round, you notice something different.
The plan was originally for a three-dimensional one, but unfortunately it's right next to the university, so we had visions of students all over it using it as a skate park and all sorts of things. You never know.
Yeah.
You can't blame Mother.
Yeah.
So we did it two-dimensional. And the idea was as well that it's unlit as well, so that when cars come up the road and round the roundabout, the headlights
light it up.
Play on the figures and the shadows of the figures move, and it looks as though the people are actually moving around the tank working on it.
Oh, wow.
So it's not my idea. That was Mike Credland, one of the designers who came up with that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What a great idea. And presumably it's there because that's where the factory was then, was it? Is that where Foster's factory was in that area?
It's the nearest area we could get to the factory. The factory is only about 200 yards down the road.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's all gone now. As I say, Foster's went out of business in the 1960s. It was there for a good while, just derelict factory, and there was lots of hopes that somebody would take it on. But eventually it was flattened in the 1980s and became an out-of-town shopping centre, as so many of our heritage sites and airfields and all sorts of things have done nowadays.
Right.
It's now, it's fed by Tritton Road, so it's named after William Tritton.
Yeah.
And the site where the factory was is completely gone. There's just a one section of wall at the back of it, about 4 foot tall, that would have been the exterior wall the back of the erecting shed where the tanks were made.
Oh,
that's still there behind Starbucks and Smith's Toy Superstore and that sort of thing.
I'll go and find that next time I'm there. I'm going to go and find
it. It's the nearest we could get to the actual factory site. Yeah.
And, and I believe that if people go to Lincoln and see the memorial, the next thing to do is to go to the Museum of Lincolnshire Life where they can see a tank. Is that right?
Yeah. We were lucky enough, again, in the 1980s, we had, there was a group called the Lincoln Tank Group. Led by a historian called Ray Hooley. And they managed to get a tank on permanent loan from Bovington Tank Museum. They were kind enough to give us a female Mark IV from 1917. And it was restored at Ruston's in Lincoln, who during the First World War, they had made parts for tanks, so that was quite fitting.
Yeah.
It's eventually found a home at the Museum of Lincolnshire Life, and it's there for everyone to see with a little film about the tanks and a... There's a German 77mm field gun that was captured by the Lincolnshire Regiment next to it, and the Lincolnshire Regiment galleries and all sorts of things. So it's worth a visit, the Lincolnshire Life Museum, definitely, yeah. The tank itself in the museum, it's been assumed that it was a tank called Flirt 2, which was captured at the Battle of Cambrai by the Germans.
Yeah.
But it's always been a bit weird. There's always been this gap between it being captured and then it appearing back at Bovington. And we've always wondered... You know, how did that happen? I was lucky enough to be with Philippe Gazansky in Flechiers.
Yep.
And he let me go inside a tank that he had dug up, this fabulous tank that's now on display. Go inside it, if you stand with your back to the front of the engine and look up at the top of the cab between the two driver's ports, you can see the number of the tank.
Mm.
That's a four-figure number. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. Next time I get a chance to look at Flirt, I'll see if I can see the number.
Mm.
And I went back, and I could just see three numbers very faintly. So I looked through my records, and I decided it could be one of three tanks. So I got in touch with a chap in Wales, Gwyn Evans, who's done a fantastic amount of research of the tanks. He knows all the numbers and when the radiators change from one to another. He's done incredible research. He had a theory that Flirt was actually... the Gloucester presentation tank. But he couldn't prove it because he didn't have the number. But I found the number. Yeah. So between us, we've managed to prove that this tank that we've got on display in Lincoln isn't the Flirt 2 that it's painted up as, that we always assumed it is.
Yeah.
It's actually the presentation tank that was given to Gloucester after the First World War. So it's nice that we actually know its true identity now.
And it would have seen service though on the Western Front.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was knocked out. It was seen by a stray shell in 1917 before it actually went into battle. And then it looks like it was withdrawn and repaired, probably just used behind the lines for training and that sort of thing.
Oh,
it's a bit sketchy, its actual history after it was damaged. It was definitely there, ready to go into battle.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it looks as though it didn't actually see any battle, but it was there.
Yeah brilliant.
There and done its bit, yeah.
I'll be up soon then, and the first thing I'll do is give you a call.
Definitely, yeah.
That'll be fantastic.
Absolutely, do that, yeah.
So what happened to the tanks was that after they had been built in Lincoln, they made the journey down to where I'm standing now, in a field just off the A11 as you go into Suffolk from the Midlands, heading towards the east coast near Thetford, not far from the United States Air Force Base at Mildenhall. There is a private estate near a village called Elverdene, famous now for the centre parks that's at the Elverdene Forest. But a few miles away from there, where I'm standing now, was the first ever tank training ground, and where those tanks were first bought in the early part of 1916, there's nothing to see here now, just fields and trees, but there was once a hell of a lot going on here. They'd built a battlefield, really. They'd brought the Somme battlefields to this quiet corner of Suffolk. There were trenches here, artificial shell holes and barbed wire, and a special railway siding as well. All this was cleared away when the tanks left to make their journey over to the Somme. The local landowner, a Lord Ivy, was the man that gave up his land for this training ground. It's about 15 square miles of land, mostly sandy soil, with vast areas of arable, heathland, rides, greens and trees. And it was ideal for tank training with just a limited number of tanks as they had at that stage. At first, the Lord was not best pleased with the thought of his pride and joy being turned over to some mysterious military purpose. It was such a secret that not even he was told. The A11 itself is dual carriageway now, busy dual carriageway, but it was a single carriageway then. That was closed down, and the first tank to arrive here was known as Mother. It was the prototype of all tanks, and it came here by railway from Lincoln on the 4th of June 1916, so this is what, 3 months before the actual first use of tanks in battle at Fleur. It arrived at the nearby Barnum station of the Great Eastern Railway, and Mother is said to have been unloaded and driven by road to Elverdon. This had to be done after dark, and the residents were warned to keep their blinds and curtains drawn and not to peek out of the window as it crawled by. The first batch of tanks arrived here on the 18th of June 1916. Apparently there were 20 more delivered on the 10th of July. And this site here at Elverdon was regarded as top secret. Screens were erected alongside the main road, what's now the A11, to hide what was going on. Military authorities called this site the Elverdene Explosives Area because loud explosions helped to confirm to the locals that this was an area that was being used for explosives. Of course, even if they'd known what was going on, they wouldn't have known what a tank was. You needed a special pass to get entry to the site. The entire site was patrolled day and night by men from the Royal Defence Corps and Cavalry, and even they had got no idea what they were guarding. They didn't know what was going on inside. Inside the centre of the site where the training was done was known as the area, and it was cordoned off and patrolled, as was the adjacent training area where all manner of training was going on that didn't involve tanks. The road that I've just driven down, the Brandon Road, present day B1100, cut right across the secret area, and that was closed at both ends to make sure that nobody could get in. And then what happened was, once they'd gathered all these tanks here, on the 21st of July 1916, so what, 3 weeks into the actual Battle of the Somme, a mock battle was arranged across this ground, across those trenches that had been built. And there was a specially invited audience of senior officers, and the Minister of Munitions at that stage, David Lloyd George, was also invited. 25 tanks took part. They moved towards the North Stow Farm, which I can see in the distance from where I am, and it was then known as the Citadel, since it was the centre of the enemy defence, or supposedly in this training exercise. The attack was apparently most successful, and it was photographed from the air by pilots from the Royal Flying Corps who were stationed at the nearby airfield at Thetford. And these photographs were processed and rushed to Elverdene in time for them to be circulated amongst the senior officers on their way on the train back to London. Unfortunately, there's no trace of those photos. They've never been found. And then 5 days later, after this, a smaller show was staged over the same ground. And on that day, there was a very special visitor here. It was His Majesty King George V. And then on the 13th of August 1916, the first tanks were moved off to France. 13 tanks from C Company of the Machine Gun Corps were loaded onto a train in the new siding that had been built. This operation took 2 nights. It could only be done at night. A second train followed, loaded with the tank sponsons, the spare guns and other stores. And then on the nights of the 24th and 25th of August, another train was loaded with the remaining 12 tanks of the company and 2 spares. Their route to France took them down to Avonmouth Docks on the Bristol Channel. They were loaded aboard ships, and after waiting 2 days for clearance, they sailed for France. They arrived at Le Havre, and the first batch of men from Southampton on the 17th, and their tanks on the 21st. And they were sent by rail to the training ground, which was near Abbeville. There were rumours that the tanks were used in battle before the 15th of September, but there's no evidence for that any. They carried on their training in the Abbeville area with another mock battle on the 26th of August. Haig was there in France. He saw that mock battle. And there was another exercise on the 1st of September. So now we're getting very close to that date of the 15th of September 1916, which we're talking about in this podcast. Now, Bovington Camp down in Dorset, that was opened in October 1916. And this field here at Elverdon returned to its previous use, farmland. arable land. It was run down, it was no longer of any use. Bovington was now the place that would be famous for tanks. But it's a special place that I've come here today. I'm on my way to a Commonwealth War Graves Commission event at a nearby RAF base. And when I started researching for this podcast, I thought it was a stroke of luck once again that this training base was just so close to where I'd be heading today. It's a place that I come past many times on the A11 on my way to Norfolk. Never imagined that this place would be here. What I did know was on the other side of the A11, as you go down to Thetford, is where Dad's Army, the outside scenes for Dad's Army were filmed. The credits at the end of the episode is filmed on the firing ranges near Thetford. But my eyes always take me over to the left. But now, whenever I come here, whenever I head for the Norfolk coast, I'll look across here to Elvedene and I'll wonder what happened to those tanks and to those men that took part in those practices. Did they survive the Battle of the Somme? Did they ever come back here? And I wonder if archaeologists ever came here and dug beneath these fields that have been ploughed of all their crops now, what they would find. Those trenches will still be there, and those memories of those men that came here in the early part of 1916.
One stared and stared, as if one had lost the power of one's limbs. The monsters approached, slowly, hobbling, rolling and swaying. But they approached. Nothing impeded them. A supernatural force seemed to impel them on.
Now, as you probably know, there's lots of books that are called the Somme and are about the Somme. But one book which I continually turn to was written by the prominent historian Richard Van Emden. You'll have seen him on lots of the documentaries, and he's written about Harry Patch and boy soldiers. But the book that I'm using for this podcast is called The Somme, The Epic Battle in the Soldiers' Own Words and Photographs. And I was fortunate enough once to meet Richard, and he told me he'd collected, and in his private collection he's got about 6,000 photographs that were taken by soldiers that were in the trenches, that were in the battlefields. And they're incredible, and he's published them in this book. So I do recommend that you get it. You can get it, it's in paperback now or hardback, and you can easily find it on Amazon or anywhere else. But in between the photographs, there's lots of individual accounts, and it's some of those that I'd like to use now and talk about now. One of them was from a gunner, William Dawson, and he says, "When unloaded, the tanks were placed on special rail trucks and each accompanied by its crew on the train to the siding. When they're unloaded, we moved across country to some fields, officers and men being billeted in the farmhouses and buildings. The camouflage that had been made so carefully and studiously carried out was immediately covered over by the Royal Engineer camouflage experts with the irregular patches of dark red, black, brown and dark green. There was also feverish activity filling ammunition belts, taking on board 6-pounder quick-firing shells, overhauling the tanks, which by now had done a considerable mileage. We also gave demonstrations before General Joffe and other French officers, Sir Douglas Haig, and a number of GHQ staff officers. It seemed as though we were being looked upon as a sort of circus, which continued when we moved to a point close behind the line near Bray-sur-Somme, known to us as Happy Valley. Crowds of officers and men from all around came to see the show, including my two brothers who were sergeants in the Coldstream Guards. They'd been told by another sergeant who'd been to Albert with the GS wagon, and he'd just seen the most amazing and weird machines that one could possibly imagine, and they concluded they must be the secret thing with which I was connected. These demonstrations were rather hard on us close before our first battle, and it meant a lot of work. In fact, one tank somehow caught fire, but with so many men and extinguisher available, it was soon out without serious damage." Now, what I've concluded from that was that these men were extremely apprehensive. As we know, previous podcast with Pete Smith, these tanks, many of them were unreliable, and this one here has caught fire before it's even reached the starting line. And the other thing which I'd not picked up on until reading this is that these men that had been trained at home in England, this was to be their first day in battle, pretty much like the men on the 1st of July, the POWs, the volunteers. This was going to be their first experience. They didn't know how these machines were going to work. They didn't know how the Germans were going to react. They didn't know whether they would be alive to tell the story. And another account on the same page in Richard's book comes from a gunner, Archie Richard. And he was on a tank that was numbered D7. And we're talking about experiences here before they've even reached the front line, before the battle. He says it took two or three days to get up to the line where we will put the noses of our tanks under a steep embankment for shelter from the shells. So don't forget, of course, the shelling's not stopping. The killing isn't stopping while these men are moving up to the start of their first battle. He goes on, he says, while we were waiting to go into action, that Jerry started to shell the ground behind the embankment where the artillery was. The gunners had come up for the attack and they had to wait for orders to move up. The shells were going over the top of us and dropping amongst the tethered horses, killing and wounding any number. We all carried revolvers, and an officer came to me and said, Richard, let's go out and see what we can do about these horses. It was a terrible sight, horses with their legs off, squirming and screaming, so we had to put them out of their misery. I remember that vividly. It was my first taste of carnage. Of course, it wasn't to be his last. Gunner Dawson, who we quoted just now, he then goes to talk about what happened as they moved up to the start line. He says, 2 nights before the attack, we started to move up from Happy Valley, and the next night we proceeded to our starting points. The way was lined with troops watching these strange and fearsome machines pass by. Our starting point was a little beyond Trones Wood and a short distance from Angle Wood, after which we were to attack the enemy lines along by Lousy Wood and beyond. The ground over which we had passed was in a terrible state. Villages blown completely away, roads obliterated and unrecognisable, woods blown to pieces, only stumps of tree remaining, trenches practically obliterated with shell holes, and other parts consisting of shell holes in shell holes, and hardly a square yard of level ground. And then he goes on to explain the reality of war. Hundreds and hundreds of dead, both German and British, with tangled barbed wire all over the place. What made it worse was rains had made the blown-up earth more difficult owing to the spongy softness. The condition of the ground could not possibly be worse. But the mood, as always with the BEF, was extremely optimistic. There was a Lieutenant Alex Thompson. He was serving with the 1st 6th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers, and he wrote a really optimistic letter to his mum back home. In fact, he gave away more information than he should have done. It's a wonder that the census didn't remove some of this information. He said, the 15th of September will truly be great for the Allies. It is hoped that this push will make the Germans retire some miles and shorten his line, or better still, if we can get cavalry through and capture his guns, surrender or rather sue for peace. We're in support of the attack and will soon be in it and we'll get most of the shelling. By the time you are starting breakfast, we'll have captured 3 objectives. A new invention is being used for the first time, and old Fritz won't like it either. You'll read about it afterwards for certain. The preparation has been tremendous and everyone has had to work night and day to get things ready and without giving old Fritz the tip what is happening. If he knew, I bet half his army would surrender tonight. There'll be no question of failure, as nothing will be able to live under the artillery fire we're going to bear on his trenches. High Wood will get something tonight and tomorrow morning. He's holding the east corner very strongly, so he will have tremendous casualties. No one knows what will happen after tomorrow. I can assure you that we are winning and winning rapidly. Your loving son, Alex. And then it was 0 hour. The tanks moved off. There was a gunner, Albert Smith. He was in a tank numbered D1. He said the going was very bad. We arrived at our starting point and Sergeant Davis was in charge. He was the gunner on the starboard side and I was a gunner on the port side with Day as loader. At 0 hour, we moved off to the roar of artillery and machine gun fire. I think we all had the wind up, but we were a good crew and we collected. We were getting along very nicely, all guns manned, when there was a crash and we stopped dead. A shell had hit us on the starboard side and Davis was shell-shocked. We put out the flags to show we'd broken down. The infantry was then passing. We could not help them. We got Davis out and the RAMC took him away. Gunner Alfred Reifer was in D17 tank, and he gives us a description of what the tank carried. He says, we were a mail tank and carried 2 6-pounder guns with several hundred rounds of ammunition and some Hotchkiss light machine guns. Our tank was full up with stores of all kinds. Drums of engine oil, gear oil, iron rations, gas masks, equipment, overalls, revolvers, helmets, carrier pigeons in a basket, semaphore signals. We even went into action with 10 times 2-gallon tins of petrol, flaming red in colour, on the outside of the tank, on either side of the exhaust pipes. And then he's put an explanation after that, because he knew damn well that a direct hit or even an indirect hit, and that petrol would go up and those tanks would turn into what was known in the Second World War as Tommy cookers. Must have been absolutely petrified, mustn't it, to see all that equipment, to see the petrol tins being loaded onto the tank, and then you get inside to go and face the strength of the German artillery. And indeed, when they went into action, they did get caught up in that German barrage, and also the barrage from their own side. Alfred says there was hell outside all right, but there was such a hell of noise inside, and we were such a tight-packed crew, we didn't just concern ourselves with what was happening outside. Our main preoccupation was doing our job, keeping our feet and keeping a warier eye out for the rock and roll of the tank. As we approached our first objective, we were stopped by an infantry runner who carried a message from his brigadier asking for our help to clear a strong point near Fleur. Our Lieutenant Hasty refused. He said his orders were to attack Fleur. And as we came into that village of Fleur, which was a heap of rubble in places, a few of the skeletons of houses were still standing. Bolt spotted a couple of German machine gunners at first floor level who were firing at us. Four rounds of six-pounder aimed at their only visible means of support at almost point-blank range was enough to put them out of action. A few yards further on, and Hasty stopped the tank and told us to strip to the waist on the starboard six-pounder as we were approaching a crossroads in the centre of the village. And 100 yards to our right, there was a German battery of field guns. As we crossed this road, we were to engage the enemy gunners with the six-pounders. So we did. We stripped to the waist, and then the tank lumbered up the main street of Fleur. We were within 50 yards of the crossroads when we were stopped again by a runner who informed us that we were in the middle of our own barrage and we had orders to retire. The infantry had apparently run into stiff opposition and the second objective had to be abandoned. Hasty turned us about and I think all of us heaved a sigh of relief. We retraced our tracks and turned back for Delville Wood. When we were about halfway between the wood and the ridge, Hasty stopped the engine and said he was going over to see the tank lying under the ridge. For the first time since the action started, our engine was silent, and we then realised there was indeed hell to pop outside. We were sitting rather helpless in the middle of one of the fiercest German barrages of the whole war. Within 5 minutes, we'd received a direct hit on the track, and we were ordered to abandon the tank. So the fact that he's around to tell the story, proof that that shell hit the track and it didn't hit those petrol tanks, otherwise we would never know what happened to him, his crew, or that tank. Now, the first tank that went into action that day, and therefore the first tank in history, was Tank D1, and it was being led by Captain Harold Mortimer, who therefore became the first man to command a tank in battle. He left his start point 100 yards south of the Longeval to Ginchy Road at 5:15 a.m. on that day, the 15th of September, and its targets were the German trenches in a position called Brewery Salient. Now, the British were using the creeping barrage on this day, and Mortimer had been told not to get too far forward because he'd strain through a British barrage. But it could be that's what happens, because a shell landed near to his tank and it put his tank out of action, and therefore it didn't get anywhere near its objectives. But the objective still had to be taken. It was the 14th Division, the infantry, that were attacking with the tanks that day, and they had to go forward without their two tanks that were supposed to be with them. I'd like to quote from another book now. It's a book written by Trevor Pidgeon, Fleur and Goodicore, one of the Pen and Sword Battleground Europe series. And he's got an account here from an infantryman that is not named. He says, "Our first line at once instinctively moved forward at the double, getting in with cold steel, but unfortunately coming under our own barrage for a moment while doing so, which was certainly less costly than being mown down by the machine gun fire. A choice of two evils, perhaps, of which they chose the right one. From T support trench, they went steadily up the hill, at the top of which was Switch trench. At the forward crest of the hill, more of the enemy were met with, who gave us considerable trouble and cost us valuable men, but there was no faltering, and these were got rid of by the same process as at T support. Once on the crest, there was found to be a plateau some 200 yards across, which came as a surprise, being difficult to see it on the map, and Switch Trench was in about the centre of it. We had some difficulty finding it, so knocked about was it, and the enemy wire did not exist at all. We did not come across a piece longer than a foot anywhere. And the view from Switch Trench is worthy of mention. We could see for miles, and Bapaume stood out in the distance. Nearer lay Goudicourt, which was our division's objectives. Fleurs to our left front and Leboeufs to our right front. During the afternoon, we saw a German counterattack on our forward line rolled up. But if anything we saw from this vantage point were to be put into this account, it would never be finished. And if you follow that route today, if you follow the road out of Delville Wood towards Ginchy, you can see exactly what they saw when you look across those battlefields. But little did they know at this stage that that objective, that first day objective, the town of Bapaume in the distance, would never be reached during the 1916 battle. There was a Sergeant Carmichael, and he was in the 21st Battalion of the King's Royal Rifle Corps. And they were in action that day, going in alongside the tanks. But of course, they were suffering heavy casualties as the Germans were fighting back. He said, "I kept an anxious eye on Kidd's section, and sure enough, before they'd gone very far, one of those confounded shells landed right in their midst, blowing them down like ninepins. I distinctly saw poor Kidd throw up his arms, and I knew that lovable, generous soul, whom I'd known since the very beginning at Helmsley, had gone west. There were only two or three survivors in the section, and those gallant fellows dragged the bodies of their killed and wounded comrades out of the path of the oncoming tank, and then went on." Carmichael himself was then wounded, shot through the leg, before he'd even reached the first German trench, and he said, "I rolled over into a shell hole. Lance Corporal Mitchell, commander of No. 7 section and a great favourite of mine, bent over me and inquired, 'Are you all right, Sergeant?' I replied, 'I'm all right, go on.' No sooner were the words out of my mouth than a shrapnel shell burst 10 feet over our heads. The splendid chap settled forward on his face, and there he knelt with a hole right through his head." The second company was coming past in little knots of men, looking fearfully at the mangled bodies of dead and wounded that littered this death-stricken ground. In the shell holes around me, I could see arms waving and hear the pitiful cries of the wounded shouting for assistance. Still bodies in strange, unnatural attitudes lay dotted about here and there. The New Zealanders were moving forward that day, and there was a runner, a rifleman Dobson, and he said the Germans had a pop at me once, and I got into a shell hole and waited then and got going again. I got inside the tank and guided it to where these machine guns were in a farm building, and the tank just pushed over it. The Germans scattered. And don't forget the secrecy. The Germans had no idea what they were facing that day. It must have come as a horrific surprise to them when they saw these lumbering tanks growling and spitting fire at them from all directions. I think I would have run, wouldn't you? And we can discover what it was like to be a German that day because we got the account of an extraordinary man called Brandhofer, an officer in the 5th Bavarian Infantry Division. In his account, he makes it clear that the tanks played a crucial role in defeating the Germans and causing the surrender of not just other men, but him and his men. In his account, he wrote, "At about 8:30 a.m, the British had already overwhelmed half of Fleurs and the southern part of the Fleurs line. A short time after, a tank appeared on the left front of my company position, which I immediately attacked with machine gun and rifle fire, and also as it came in closer with hand grenades. These unfortunately caused no real damage because the tank only turned slightly to the left, but otherwise just carried on. He crossed the trenches in the area of my company on my left, caused us heavy losses with his flanking machine gun fire of trenches, which had to a large extent been flattened without any men being able to do anything against it. He then proceeded in the direction of the road from Fleurs. Positioning himself close to the exit from Fleurs, he placed the whole length of this road under continuous machine gun fire. Well hidden by the houses and buildings, the enemy advanced into the north and northwest ends of Fleurs and thereby worked round to our rear. From here and from directly to our left, he now attacked, first of all taking the entire length of our position under continuous machine gun fire and causing more heavy losses to my company. It was now completely impossible to retreat because all the ground which we might have considered for this purpose was under continual bombardment. And if we had attempted to withdraw, the rest of my company would have been totally annihilated within a few minutes. I succeeded in holding out until midday. At that time, the enemy once more made a mass attack simultaneously from the left and rear, this time with even stronger overwhelming superiority. The attack from the left was led by a tank which, armed with small cannons, came from the flank and fired upon our whole position with devastating effect. The attack itself was carried out with hand grenades and bayonets, Under such circumstances, it was quite impossible to hold out any longer. Further resistance would have led to a completely pointless massacre of the remainder of my company. So he surrendered and he was taken prisoner. But a few months later, he escaped from a prisoner of war camp, a British prisoner of war camp, and he found his way back to Germany. So 2 points I've taken from that account is that, 10 weeks or so, 8, 9, 10 weeks after the 1st of July, when we know that the bombardment, the British bombardment of the German first lines had failed to destroy the barbed wire, here we are, they've used much heavier artillery, concentrated artillery over a much narrow objective, and this time it's worked. And also the fact that this German officer escaped from a prisoner of war camp, we hear all these heroic stories about British prisoners escaping in both World War I and World War II. It wasn't just the British, some of the Germans escaped as well. They too were brave men. And this next account was written by a man called Second Lieutenant Hatton. He was in D Company, and his account is absolutely horrific. He said there was a Lieutenant Court who was commanding D-14 tank. And initially they were told that their attack was cancelled and he was jubilant, but then he was back on again. He said, Court and I had a conference and we drank a considerable amount of rum and Court started up. He led up the high street of Fleur. I followed him up the high street and I had in my path about 2,000 dead British and German soldiers. Any attempt to clear the dead from our path was impossible because of the shelling and we ploughed over the lot of them. Court put his nose out of Fleur and the German concentrated their fire on him. I followed and soon I was being covered by shell fire. My driver Archer called and said, I cannot see, sir, and I swept him out of his driving seat and called for Corporal Sanders to take his place. Where to, sir, he said. Follow Court, I said. We lifted the small armoured flap and we saw Court's tank and it stopped. There was a small dense column of smoke arising from it and then it exploded. I ordered Saunders on. He was shocked at what had happened. So we all were who were inside tank D9. But we were then almost astride T Trench, and our starboard guns were trained on about 400 bewildered Germans who were burrowing down like rabbits seeking cover from our machine guns. When we'd finished on T Trench, we went towards Goodicore, but I'd noticed that my port guns had not fired a shot. I went over to the two gunner boys. They were huddled over their machine guns. I kicked them, but I got no response. They were dead. Machine gun bullets had penetrated the tank. We struggled on with nothing to fire at, but as we got to Goodicore, Jerry slapped shell after shell into us until one penetrated the forward part of the tank and we caught fire. What happened then, I cannot tell you. I believe there was an explosion and I was on top of my corporal, who had his shins sticking out in the air. There were two other survivors. Saunders was shrieking with pain, but fortunately I'd provided him with morphia so that I could quieten a wounded man. I plugged Saunders with morphia and I sent the other two survivors to try and get help, but they were never seen again. I remained with Saunders in a shell hole in the German lines. I banished him and I gave him more morphia, and all he could say was, for God's sake, shoot me, sir. Well, it's a good job he didn't, because Hatton goes on to say that Saunders was taken through our lines and was immediately sent to England, and I had the pleasure of visiting him in a Kentish hospital. Now, just to finish with this week, I've got a couple of additional stories. In the interview with Richard Pullen, he mentioned presentation tanks. These were the tanks that were sent to, I think it was 125 towns up and down the country that had held tank weeks in order to raise money for the production of these steel monsters. And in October of 1919, one of these tanks was sent to my hometown of Northampton. And it was supposed to be driven from Castle Station through the town centre up to Abington Park, where it was going to be displayed. But in true tank tradition, it broke down and it took several months before it finally arrived in Abington Park, where it stood alongside a mound of earth, which it was believed was an ancient burial mound. And it was there for 15 years and kids used it as a climbing frame, and slowly but surely it started to deteriorate in condition. And then in the mid-1930s, 1935 came along, and one of the local councillors, who was a Quaker, he was worried that the tank would have a detrimental effect on the people of Northampton. It would create some kind of war culture. And by this time, of course, we had the rise of the Nazis in Germany, and the country was realising perhaps that war was about to come again. So the council held a meeting as to what to do with the tank, and it was decided that the tank should go. But how it should go gave birth to a local myth, a local legend, which after COVID I did several walks around Northampton, around Hampton Park, and I disappointed dozens, I think, of local people when I told them that the tank is not actually buried under that burial mound, that hill that locals call Tanky Hill in Northampton. No, that was a myth. One of the councillors did suggest that it should be buried there, but that was going to be impractical, of course, because the first thing that would happen was that kids would dig it out. And what actually happened was it was sold for scrap to a firm from Sheffield, and they came down to Northampton in 1935 with some electric steel cutters. They cut up the tank, they took it back to Sheffield, and they turned it into knives and forks. So that tank is more likely to be in the cutlery drawer of the people of Northampton rather than beneath that burial mound. It really did cause a lot of distress to some people when for all of their lives they believed that that tank was buried under that hill, but it wasn't. And the other thing that happened just yesterday was just after I'd finished recording the interview with Richard, I went off to the Holt Cemetery here in Norfolk, where, as a volunteer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, I'm part of the Eyes on Hands On project, and I had to photograph the dozen or so commissioned headstones that are in the cemetery so we can check on their condition. And then just as I was leaving, I noticed one of those small wooden crosses that people leave on graves. And I thought, well, this is strange, because the grave that it's on is not on my list. And it was a private memorial, which is not unusual. There's a lot of private memorials from soldiers that died and are buried in our local cemeteries. But this one wasn't. This said on this headstone that it was erected in memory of two soldiers called Caston that had died on the Western Front in 1916 and 1918. But it was a really hot day yesterday, but a cold shiver went down my spine. I'd spent the last 2 days recording these podcasts about that date, the 15th of September 1916, and then lo and behold, one of these Caston boys, Albert Caston, had been killed in action, it said on this headstone, on that date, the 15th of September 1916. So I couldn't wait to get back to base, and I looked up, and there indeed, he did die on that date. He has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial. He was part of the 9th Battalion of the Norfolk Regiment, and they were in action on that day, the first day that tanks were involved. He was in the infantry supporting the tanks, or the other way around perhaps, and he was one of over 400 casualties. I think there was about 130 that were killed that day that have no known grave. What are the chances of that? Again, almost every week now I talk about coincidences. A number of issues here. You know, I didn't know he was buried there, or he's not buried there. I didn't know he was remembered there. I just was leaving the cemetery at the end of doing my work, and just that wooden cross just caught my eye, and it made me look at that headstone. His family are buried there. His mother's, I think, in the family grave there. And you can only just about read the writing, because the obviously the headstone is over 100 years old, probably hasn't been cared for in recent years. But it felt like Caston was leading me to him, and next time I go to the Somme, I'll go and find his name on the Teat Vale Memorial. And then there was another entry just below, and it talks about his brother Alfred, and he died in tragic circumstances, because on the 29th of July 1918, he was with the one of the East Surrey battalions, and he was driving a horse and some limbers, and it was being loaded with tin ready for the forthcoming offensive around Amiens that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And his service file shows that the horses bolted because the noise of the loading tin made them scared. And he tried to hold on to the horses. He fell off the horse and the wheels of the limber went over him, caused terrible injuries to him. And he was killed almost immediately. There was no blame attached to him. It was just one of those awful accidents that happen sometimes. And so the family from Holt had lost two sons, one in 1916, the Battle of the Somme, and one in a freak accident 2 years later. I wonder, like all these families, how they ever recovered from that. So that's the end of the podcast for this week. Thank you once again for tuning in. Please do continue to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get it from. I think it's on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music are the three main ones, but it pops up on other platforms as well. And all it remains for me to do is to play the last post in memory of all those soldiers that died at Fleur and in the surrounding villages in September of 1916, and also those two Caston boys. And also we remember all of those workers that helped build those first tanks in Lincoln, the men and the women and the designers. They've all passed on now, and so we remember them by playing The Last Post.